The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
There are four spots.
All right, well, I don't want to waste people's time, so we could go ahead and start. I know there's supposed to be at least one other faculty member here. So I don't know how many of these you've been to. This one's supposed to cover administrative law, constitutional law. I'm happy to answer questions. I'm happy to give opening advice. It might make more sense for you to ask questions if you have them, because then I'm talking about the things you want me to talk about. But if not, I will cover other things. For those of you that I don't know, I'm Steve Wormiel, and I'm one of the constitutional law teachers, and I also work in the program on law and government. Most of the people in the room are my con law students. There are a couple of you that aren't, so I'm happy to have you here. And how do you want to start? Do you want me to talk about particular courses? Do you have specific things you're thinking about? Either way. I'm only teaching the evening con law class in the fall and the Marshall Brennan seminar. But you definitely shouldn't take anything with Steve Vlad. Oh, hi, Steve. How are you?
No, please don't take my classes, and I have no work to do. This is my new philosophy on class advice. Take anybody but me.
So this is Professor Vladek, if you don't know him. And for the person that just came in, I'm Steve Wormiel. We both teach constitutional law. He also teaches federal courts and national security related things. I teach a seminar in the Supreme Court, although I'm not teaching it next year, and I teach in the Marshall Brennan program. And we are happy to talk about con law courses, administrative law courses, or anything else.
Government.
Government related courses, regulatory courses, and so on. You want to talk about your courses for a minute, or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm only teaching one in the fall, so
why don't you describe it?
I'm teaching a seminar on the history of habeas corpus. The idea behind the seminar is in a lot of contemporary litigation, especially arising out of Guantanamo and the war on terrorism, there's been a lot of fighting over what habeas corpus actually protects and what the Constitution codifies when it says habeas corpus is protected except in cases of rebellion or invasion. And so the question is, what did the framers mean? How did they who wrote the Constitution understand habeas corpus to be at the time of the Constitution in a way that actually helps us understand what rights individuals have today when we say they are protected by the suspension clause? So it's going to be really a legal history seminar as much as anything else, where we both do some historical work and try to figure out how that historical work matters today.
And are you doing that with an eye toward, I mean, is there a way that the focus of the historical discussion will be aimed at informing the Guantanamo
yes.
debate, or it's just a general history?
No. I mean, I think our hope will be, and indeed students, I think, will be encouraged to find specific topics about how properly understanding the historical conversation and properly focusing on what the framers understood actually changes some of the things we think about the Guantanamo cases and some of the things we think about, you know, more routine post-conviction habeas cases today. So it's a very presentist kind of class, but it'll be a lot of historical research as well.
And then in the spring, will you teach Fed courts again?
Yes. So, I mean, I'm happy to say a word about federal courts. So federal courts, you know, you may have heard a little bit about. Some people refer to it as the organic chemistry of law school. There's no chemistry in it, so I don't quite get that. But anyway, federal courts is basically some combination of an advanced civil procedure class and an advanced constitutional law class that looks at the world from the perspective of the federal courts. why do we have federal courts in particular? What unique role do the federal courts serve? What kind of powers do the other branches of the federal government have over the federal courts? What kind of powers do the federal courts have over the other branches of the federal government? How do the federal courts relate to the states, etc.? I've described it sometimes as both the most theoretical and most practical class in law school, because in some sense, it's about a conversation full of questions that have never been answered, about the limits of Congress's power over the courts, and so on. And in some sense, it's about how the world really works, like how the courts actually do their job when cases are brought before them. So it really is a hybrid of very theoretical legal conversations and very practical ones. It's a four-credit course. It has been the law school's practice, at least lately, to offer it every semester. Professor Amanda Frost, who is fantastic, is teaching it in the fall, and I am scheduled to teach it in the spring, although there's, you know, a very, very small chance that might not happen, but at least that's the plan.
I would strongly recommend it. I think if you see yourself as a litigator in federal court, it really is an essential course. It really sort of gives you the, in con law, we're giving you the, for lack of a better description, we're giving you the substance of the meaning of the Constitution, but that doesn't tell you how to get those cases into court. Where does jurisdiction come from? What are you suing under? What about mixed federal claims and state claims? What about there's a lot more to mootness and ripeness and justiciability than what, at least what my con law class did. We just introduced the topic. And so to really understand how to litigate in federal courts, I think you need the course.
And just, I mean, I think just to understand how the federal courts, you know, work. My other class is con law. I'm going to assume that most of you guys will not need to take con law next spring. So the other class that I usually teach that I'm not teaching next year is being taught by our colleague Dan Marcus. It's technically called National Security in an Age of Terrorism. It's really just a national security law course. And this is basically a survey-ish elective focusing on specific topics in contemporary national security law, ranging from Guantanamo to surveillance to, you know, things having nothing to do with terrorism, such as disaster relief, to the domestic use of the military. You know, lots of interesting and hot-buttony topics, although perhaps less immediately relevant to what many people will do when they graduate from law school. And that's being offered in the fall. I don't think there's currently a plan to offer that course next spring. It's been more of our convention as of late to offer it once a year.
So let me then also say a couple things about administrative law. There are, in a sense, and again, this is sort of overgeneralizing, oversimplifying, but there are, in a sense, kind of two ways to think about administrative agencies. Each administrative agency has substantive law that it enforces. The Federal Communications Commission has a bunch of statutes that govern communications law, licensing of broadcast, regulating cable, some discussion of regulating the internet, and so on. The Federal Trade Commission has consumer protection laws. The Securities and Exchange Commission has securities laws. So each agency has its own substantive law. And then there's administrative law, which is sort of like the civil procedure of all of the agencies. The administrative law course covers what's called the Administrative Procedure Act, which is like the federal rules of civil procedure for practicing in front of the administrative agencies. How do agencies adopt rules? What are the regulations that govern the agency's actions? How do the agencies seek notice and comment for a rule? How do they adjudicate matters before them? What kind of due process do you get? What are the procedures involved, and so on? So in administrative law, you're not learning about a particular agency. You're learning about a cross-cutting set of practice principles. if you are interested in a particular area of practice that involves a particular agency, then you probably want to do both. You probably want to take administrative law and get your feet wet in particular substantive areas of different agencies. If you're interested in the FCC, take communications law with Vicki Phillips in the fall. If you're interested in environmental law, take the basic environmental law course. If you're interested in the NLRB, take labor and employment law with DATS, who's an adjunct, and so on. But also take administrative law, because that's the touchstone to understanding the practice part of all the agencies. We offer administrative law both in the fall and the spring. The more substantive components, like communications law, environmental law, and so on, we probably won't be offering every semester. They'll probably only be offered one semester, but administrative law will be offered both semesters. If you're going to practice in Washington, I mean, if you are sure that you're going to be a Washington lawyer and not doing primarily criminal work, administrative law is a pretty important thing to have. It would be hard to navigate through Washington practice without encountering administrative law issues at some point. What else? It's hard to think of constitutional law as a practice area. I mean, in a sense, it's not. This session is a little different than maybe some of the other sessions. They're talking about pensions and health care next door, and those are kind of succinct practice areas where you can learn a body of law and practice in that field. Constitutional law is a little harder to do that. So there isn't sort of anything that I would say, gee, you have to take these courses because you're going to need them to practice constitutional law. Constitutional law kind of cuts across. Outside of the constitutional law classroom, constitutional law in the real world sort of cuts across different fields. You know, there's not a course to take to learn the constitutional law issues that may be raised in conjunction with the health care bill or you know, some other field. It's really more kind of finding the constitutional issues in different fields. Having said that, there are interesting courses. There's First Amendment, which we don't cover in most of the constitutional law classes. So First Amendment is a separate standalone class. And our colleague Professor Marcus is teaching that in the fall. It's a fun, interesting class. It's not something that you have to have to practice. I think it's something you have to have to be a citizen, but you know, nobody listens to me, so.
What?
Nobody listens to me.
What? What?
All right, so what else?
There's also one of our adjuncts is teaching a comparative constitutional law class in the fall, which is always an interesting way of seeing how things look across borders. Bill Yeomans is teaching what legislative process.
Yeah.
So that's sort of, you know, I think from Professor Yeoman's perspective, that's more a how laws are made course, but there's also the other side of legislation, which is how statutes are interpreted in court. I don't know if anyone's teaching that in the fall, but that probably means we'll be teaching it in the spring. You know, I mean, I think we have a wide range of public law offerings. I think it's just a question of which make the most sense for you, and that's why, you know, I think these sessions are as helpful to give you guys a chance to ask us questions as it is to have us just talk at you. So I'm sort of out of specific things to recommend.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say in the realm of constitutional law, there are many, many courses that sort of touch on other aspects of constitutional law. You know, yeah. There's sexuality in the law, there's reproduction in the law, there's gender discrimination and the law.
Critical race theory.
All of those are things that have a constitutional law aspect to them. I think, when is state constitutional law? That's a spring course.
Yeah, it's usually in the spring.
We have an adjunct who teaches a course in state constitutions, which is an interesting course, how state constitutional law can evolve separately from federal constitutional law and what role it plays and so on. But maybe we should take Professor Vladek's suggestion and see what questions you have.
these classes that aren't both 2Ls and 3Ls, or the majority 3Ls? I mean, I think seminars in particular, those seem like they would fill up faster.
I mean, there's nothing that's closed to you as a 2L. It's really, as you said, a question of how registration plays out. I don't think, for the most part, I would be worried about being one of a couple of 2Ls in a class that's mostly 3Ls. They may think they're smarter than you are, but they're not really.
I think that's right. I think... it happens, you know, it happens sometimes. So my federal course class this semester, I think I've got 53 L's and 4 2Ls. And the 2Ls are doing fine. If anything, the 2Ls are the ones who don't have 3L-itis. And so they're actually still doing the reading.
Yeah, I mean, I've had that experience with my Supreme Court seminar where the 3Ls are all kind of coasting and the 2Ls are totally gung-ho and anxious to participate, and that's more fun.
The only place it ever shows up is if courses have prerequisites. And there, the issue is not, are you a 2L or a 3L? There, the issue is just, have you had prior coursework that prepares you for what's going on? But for courses that don't have prerequisites, I think the general assumption is that 2Ls are as capable, if not more capable, of doing the work. And it's really just purely a question of registration priority. Which leads me to one of my other points is, you know, just because a course has a wait list, don't assume you can't get off of it. Every semester that I've had a course with a wait list, by the end of ad drop, there are actually open spaces in the class. Sometimes that's because people just don't realize that there are open spaces. Sometimes it's because people give up. If you really want to take a course, you know, be persistent. You never know where that'll get you.
Administrative law, is it recommended, or would you say it's it would be necessary if you were on administrative law review to take in the fall?
I actually asked the new editor-in-chief this morning that question, and she said no. It may be preferable to take it in the fall, but it's not critical and isn't necessarily going to hamper your ability to function in the journal if you wait till spring.
Although, I mean, depending on when you want to write your comment, you know, your comment might be greatly aided by taking admin, or at least you might have to do less work on your comment if you don't have to sort of teach yourself administrative law before you start writing your comment.
Okay, so there's a bunch of courses that I am thinking about, and I just don't know if there's a significant overlap with them or if there's a trajectory that I should be thinking about, those being admin, First Amendment, advanced common law, advanced civil rights, and civil rights and remedies. I wouldn't need to take, like, a different one.
Which advanced common law?
Yeah, advanced common law.
That's the Marshall Brennan seminar, which you can't take. Yeah. 707-002.
The book has it differently, right? Because the book is so the
you
book
have
is
to look
older
at which than the, what 707s are being offered. You have to look at the schedule.
Okay.
I mean, in other words, right? I mean, this is sort of Greek to us sometimes, but some of the courses are courses with a title whose substance changes over time. So 707 is generally advanced constitutional law, but what that is each semester may depend on who's teaching it and what they're doing. That also affects the overlap question. For the most part, I mean, admin and the First Amendment are completely divorced from each other. Advanced con law and the First Amendment are usually divorced from each other because we teach a separate First Amendment course.
I mean, we have 5 707s in the fall.
Yeah.
One is the Marshall Brennan seminar. One is called Problems in the Democratic Process with Professor Schwartz, which I think you could take. Comparative constitutional law with an adjunct, I think, would be fine. Legislative process, congressional oversight with yeomans, and legislation, congressional lawmaking, I think, also with yeomans. I think you could take any of those in any sequence you wanted. I don't think it would really matter.
Yeah, I mean, and as for overlap, I think that's really just a question of looking at the syllabi. Or at least of talking to the professors. For the most part, we try to avoid overlap. Sometimes it's unavoidable, So, for example, you know, there are cases that you just have to teach as part of, you know, both an administrative law course and, say, federal courts. I mean, you'll read Kroll versus Benson, for example, in both classes. You know, I wouldn't worry about the overlap that much. And unless there are specific prerequisites, I wouldn't even worry about the sequencing that much. Because, you know, usually we only, when we're worried about the sequencing, we usually tell you. And we sort of say, you know, you should have this before you do that. It's more common, in my experience, in our curriculum, to see sequencing in some of the business law classes, in some of the tax law classes, and in areas where we really do have a set curriculum that goes through multiple levels. In the public law field, you know, the diversity of the offerings is such that, you know, they talk to each other, but there's no, I think, understanding that you take this and then that.
I mean, there's, you know, there's sort of urban legends about practical advice about things. Like, some people will say, wait and take conflicts of laws in your third year. Conflicts involves sort of resolving jurisdictional disputes. If you have a contract that involves the law of two different states, how do you decide which state's law is going to prevail? And so in the course of studying contracts, or studying conflicts, you're actually touching on some torts and some contracts and different fields. And so some people say, gee, that's a good thing to take as a third year, because it's kind of a mini refresher. I guess I've heard people say the same thing about remedies. Mm-hmm. Remedies is what it sounds like. It's sort of the, what's the bottom line? What's the end result? What kind of remedies do you ask for in a constitutional litigation or a contract litigation or a tort suit or something like that? But so it also kind of touches on some different subjects.
But it's really chicken and the egg, right? Because just as, you know, some of those classes are useful to sort of remind you about things you've done previously, it works just as well in the other direction, where they might prepare you for other fields. I mean, that's why I would take seriously the notion that if we really didn't think you should take one class before taking another one, we would tell you. And that everything else is just sort of personal preference and as Professor Rumil says, urban legend.
What else?
That's the administrative law class.
Yeah.
In your opinion, do you think it touches upon the different agencies with enough depth that you'd be able to sort of get a understanding of what the agencies are and what they do?
No.
Not at all.
The problem is that there's so much, there's so many agencies, and they do so many different things. Oftentimes, depending on who's teaching it, they may teach it through the particular lens of a small handful of agencies. So, you know, I think one of our colleagues spends a lot of time on the Environmental Protection Agency. But that's not, you know, administrative law really is the generalist class. And if you're interested in particular agencies, it's much more likely you're going to find what you want to know about them in a specific upper-level advanced, you know, administrative law kind of class. Or not even an advanced administrative law class. I mean, I think about something like immigration law, which is an entirely administrative body of law, but which is in so many profound ways different from classical administrative law, that it really is about what agency and why.
I mean, we have a unique course that's been offered here since I was a student here 100 years ago. That's offered at night in summer school called Federal Regulatory Process. And that is, I guess if summer school is 9 weeks long, each night of the 9 weeks, they do a different agency. And they bring in a guest speaker from a different agency. And so you're learning a little bit of administrative law, but you're also kind of getting an introduction to the substantive law of a bunch of different agencies. And I think that's being offered this summer, too. But that's about the only place you're going to get that kind of overview. And even that, you know, leaves out 10 more agencies.
The second part to the question, for summer school or summer programs, I know law and government is this their first year that it's really going on. Is it something? Do Do you happen to know if it's going to be offered next summer as well, if this is going to continue?
He's a guy to ask.
If I'm going to remain employed, it's going to be offered next summer too, yes.
Okay.
I'd be willing to stick that he'll still be employed, so.
Yes, the goal is to do this every summer. The first week is sort of a general Washington practice, regulatory practice focus. The second week is more specific to financial regulation. In my perfect vision of this, we might change the second week each year to respond to sort of hot topics. So, you know, if a year from now we're past the financial crisis and Congress has re-regulated everything and it's all working and there's nothing to talk about, I can't imagine that, but if that were true, maybe we would, if they're in the middle of immigration reform, maybe we would do the second week focusing on immigration instead of financial regulation, or you know, something, or education if they're in the middle of fighting over the reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind Act or something like that. So we might not always have the securities and banking focus that we're having in the second week. Yeah.
Is the Summer Law and Government program, is it open now to register for the individual sections?
Yes, you register, you go into the regular, you click on the regular summer school registration and you register. I've made this as complicated and difficult to follow as humanly possible so that I would have something to do. You register for a course that you won't see on the summer school schedule. It's Law 2010, Summer Institute Law and Gov. And there are five sections, 001 through 005, which reflects the number of credits you want. So if you wanted to register for 3 credits in the Summer Institute, you would register for Law 2010, Summer Institute Law and Gov, 003 for 3 credits. And then you can fill out your preference for the different 3-hour course blocks.
Well, that's the part. Where do I do that?
On the Summer Institute website.
Okay. Professor Vladek, earlier you said something about critical race theory.
Mm-hmm.
What course is that?
That may not be in the catalog. It's
where is it offered this?
Yeah, Leah's teaching it. One of our new hires, Professor Leah Epperson, who's really fantastic, is teaching it. Critical race theory is basically, it's a school of legal philosophy that is dedicated to the notion. It's an offshoot of critical legal studies, which is its own school of legal philosophy, and it's basically looking at the law not just through the conventional critical lens, but actually through the lens of critical race. And it's basically looking at anti-discrimination law through that lens, looking at public benefits law through that lens. So I don't know exactly how Professor Epperson is going to teach it, but I suspect it will be part theory and part application, where first you learn about what critical race theory is and what the assumptions are that gives rise to it, and then about how that actually affects interpretations of individual cases, ways of reconceptualizing doctrine, et cetera. I mean, it's one of, you know, any number of competing schools of thought about how to approach law, but it's a particularly important one, and I think Professor Epperson is well qualified to teach it and to speak to it. She's currently visiting at the University of Maryland, so it's possible she may already have a syllabus up there for if she's teaching it there. So it might not be that hard to track down information about it. I would say, as a general rule, you should never be shy about contacting professors and asking them, you know, if they have a syllabus or if they're at least willing to answer questions about their courses. They may not, but then you know worse off. The other thing is, from our perspective, the most accurate schedule is the one that the registrar posts to the website. So it's very possible there will be classes on here that you've never heard of that aren't in the print catalog because they weren't ready at press time. It's probably worth sort of perusing this, a couple times just to make sure you haven't missed any sort of interesting sounding classes. But yeah, I think critical research.
And that's where updates will take place,
yep.
too. Like, there's some places where the who's teaching it is omitted.
Yep.
Because they're still
looking.
Or like Bill Yeomans hadn't totally worked out whether he was going to be teaching this next year, but now he is, so I think they'll add him to the website in the next few days.
And let me just say, I mean, so for example, there are two other, well, there's one other professor we've hired for next year who isn't on the schedule yet at all, Professor Lindsay Wiley, who's going to be teaching health law and health law related classes. You know, let me sort of put in a general plug for don't be shy of new professors. We hire them for a reason. And, you know, there's the obvious tendency to not take someone if they're new. But Professor Wiley, Professor Epperson, and Professor Roberts in the clinic have all taught before. And I think, you know, you can get them while they're good before they become too popular.
Or too jaded.
Let me just put it this way. My first year here, even though I'd been teaching for 2 years already, I had 17 people in my federal courts class. I'd like that again.
To you, I have heard Amanda more than you say take Fed Courts as a third year, not as a second year, because it's better if you know more law. Is that, do you speak to that?
I'm of two minds on that. I mean, I think it is certainly true that the more diverse things you're exposed to before you take federal courts, the more ready you are for it. The flip side is, you know, taking federal courts prepares you to handle advanced topics better. So I really do think it's a sort of six in one, half dozen the other. There are benefits to waiting until you're 3L. There are detriments to waiting until you're 3L. The only thing I'll say is whenever you, if you choose to take federal courts, and there are reasons not to do it, although I can't fathom what they are. Kidding. If you choose to take federal courts, be ready to work. It is a very intensive class. And so, you know, knowing that you have a semester where you're going to have the time to really put in the effort may be a lot more important than whether it's particularly one semester or the other of your second or third year. But Professor Frost may feel differently. That's just my view.
For those of you just coming in, I'm Steve Wormiel, and this is Steve Vladek.
I am.
They know who you are.
Yeah.
So half of them are your students and half of them are my students.
What else? Yeah?
Someone told me from another section they had a really in-depth, I guess, thing with their professors, and they told them that they needed to take classes like tax and business association, mm-hmm. and like listed all of these classes that made me want to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to know how important those were and if, like, you actually do have to take that, or if I can just wait for Barbary to teach me that stuff.
So my
there's multiple answers to that.
I'll give you mine.
First one, before you say that, I'll just say we're firmly committed to your not wanting to die.
Correct.
That's
what
would be my first answer.
Until you take that course, and then I can't vouch for that. My students have heard me say this before. I think that is bad advice. And by that I mean the notion that there are classes that you have to take or else you'll somehow be poorly educated. The only, if you think about it backwards, Barbary is designed to prepare you for the bar. Now, Barbary, to that end, reteaches you everything that we're supposed to have taught you in law school. The only place where I think having taken the classes in law school matters is for the multi-state. Because you have to know so much more and in so much more depth come the time of the bar for multi-state topics than you do for the particular substantive topics of your state bar. So my advice, such as it is that the classes you should take in law school are the multi-state classes. Now, the reason why that works out well for you is because we make you take all of them except evidence. And so that's why my view, idiosyncratic though it may be, has always been the only class you absolutely have to take that we already require you to take as evidence. And that everything else is all about whether it makes sense for what you want to do in your career, not whether you need it for the bar. It is certainly true that BA will help you when it comes time to prepare for the bar, but it's also true that plenty of people have never taken BA and have taken Barbary and have passed the bar. So, you know, it's a very personal decision which classes you feel like you should take. The only class I really think that for bar purposes you have to take that we don't make you take already is evidence. That's only my view.
I mean, I don't disagree with that, but I would add one dimension to it, which is in terms of thinking about the importance of a class, not that you have to take it, but why would you want to take it, you might think broadly about the value of some classes.
That's right.
Like BA may not be essential to you if you're not going to practice securities law. But if you're a consumer lawyer suing corporations, if you're a white-collared criminal defense lawyer dealing with corporate criminals, if you're a prosecutor prosecuting corporate crime, those wouldn't be the first things you'd think of in saying, I need to take BA, but BA would be pretty helpful for all of those things.
And note that what we're saying isn't inconsistent, right? I'm just saying don't take it for the bar. Right, there may be other reasons to take it. I just want to be clear that I think from the perspective of classes you need for the bar, there aren't many.
I mean, I think you could go around the building, you'd probably only find 10 professors here, but the 10 that you find, each one would give you a different answer.
That's right.
I don't think we disagree. I mean, I think what you'd find is different people who think that one is easier to learn in a bar review course than another. I think tax is a set of rules that with a couple of hours of memorization you can learn more than adequately to pass the bar exam.
Besides, tax is not in most bars.
But some people find it very interesting. There are actually interesting policy issues implicated in the tax code.
And this goes to my larger piece of advice, which is be careful to separate out reasons. You know, there are any number of reasons why a class might make sense that don't have to do with it's fun and it's interesting. Right? And so the key is, what are the reasons why you want to take particular classes? And all I'm saying here is that if your particular reason is because I need it for the bar, I resist that notion. For everything except evidence. There could be any number of other reasons to take any of those classes. And you may well decide that you should. I just think that for the specific purpose of being ready for Barbary, it's overrated. You guys have heard that spiel before.
And are you convinced?
No? I'll tell you what, after the bar exam, come back and talk to me.
All right, what else?
Ask us anything.
Yeah. I came in late, so I'm sorry if we've gone over this. But
if I'm
interested in appellate level federal litigation, and not necessarily sure on which topic, more the practice itself, are there classes that are important to take, or is kind of practical experience and externships and things like that more important to focus on and just take what you're interested in while you're here?
For appellate level federal litigation in particular, I would say there actually are a few classes that are probably particularly useful. I wouldn't say important, I would just say useful. Federal courts, but also appellate advocacy. And I have to say, I think administrative law. Because a lot of appellate litigation these days is challenging administrative regulations in the courts of appeals. There are lots of others that get into more specific substantive areas that are often the source of federal appellate litigation, but insofar as sort of the structure of federal appellate litigation, those three. I'd also add, when next you teach it to upperclassmen, Professor Wermiel's Supreme Court seminar, which is about Supreme Court litigation, which is a very specific species of appellate litigation, but which raises a lot of the same, a lot of appellate litigation, even at the circuit level, is driven by expectations about the Supreme Court. And so, are you teaching that? You're teaching that to 1Ls next year?
I think next spring, but I would then try to do it as a upper-level course in the following fall.
So that would be my fourth.
So fall of your third year. And the only caveat I would add to that is if it somehow turned out that you were doing criminal work, then you'd want to take habeas courses, because any federal appellate litigation involving criminal issues is going to be habeas litigation.
And so with regard to habeas, I cover it in federal courts a little bit. Professor Frost, I think, does not. Although her syllabus might have changed since the last time she taught it. Professor Robbins, from time to time, offers a class specifically called Post-Conviction Remedies. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm teaching a seminar next fall about the history of habeas, although that's more legal history than it is current appellate litigation. Other questions? ruminations, observations.
What else are you thinking about? We'll, you know, you can tell we're not shy. We'll speak about anything.
Who should be the next Supreme Court Justice?
That's a good question, I'm sure.
Elizabeth Warren. She won't be, but, you know. Sidney Thomas.
That seems to be the hot one lately. Jason.
There are a few courses that look interesting, like law and literature or legal history. Is there any practical value to them?
You answer that one. You want me to turn the podcast off?
No. I think the question is, what do you mean by practical value? Are they going to teach you skills that are going to be of use to you as a lawyer in the real world? Probably not. They're not meant to be transactional skills classes. They're not meant to sort of teach you about a particular body of law that matters. Are they ways of thinking about the law that might, you know, broaden your horizons, that might diversify your understandings, that might, you know, help you see new ways of looking at old problems? Sure. And so, you know, I think they're not directly practical in that they're hands-on training to be a professional. But you may have noticed, you know, an overwhelming majority of what we do here is not hands-on training designed to show you how to be a professional. So, no, they're not practically useful. Are they completely useless in training you to be a really good lawyer? Not at all. It's just, it's a different kind of training. It's training you to sort of think about the law differently. Even if it's not about how you actually go about applying things.
Then on the back side of that, would those courses on a transcript be suspicious to an employer?
I think so. When I was in law school, we were always told that you had to watch the number of law and classes that you took. But that's because when I went to law school, no one thinks we learned any law. I don't think one or two of them are suspicious. I think if the only thing on your transcript was law and classes, that would stand out. You know, employers these days, I think, I can't imagine, except in the most hyper-specific field, are going to be bothered that you took a legal history class or that you took law and literature. You know, it's not about whether there's one class on your transcript. It's about what the sort of body of work is. So I wouldn't shy away from a class because you think it might look odd on your transcript. I think it's just a question about how your transcript looks as a whole when the time comes. The other part of it is if you're at a point where the employers are scrutinizing your transcript to see more than just what grades you got in your classes, you're doing well. But that's just me.
No, I would share that. I mean, I think you don't want your transcript to look soft, but... But I don't think one class or two classes does that.
Law and film, maybe. Do we teach law and film?
Mark Niles used to teach law and popular culture, which was law and film, but hasn't taught it for
a while. When I was in law school, the gut that everyone knew was a gut was law and film.
Law and popular culture, they sat there and watched movies every week.
Easy class. Like Rocks for Jocks, but for lawyers. Other questions? Other randomness?
Yeah. I was thinking of taking the government liability class. Would you recommend that as a...
Who's teaching that?
Which class is that? What number? Do you know?
I don't know if the number is being taught by Alan.
By?
Alan Feldman.
Oh. Interesting. It's an interesting class. I mean, it's... I don't know how he teaches it, so I don't know if it's heavily doctrinal. You know, government suing the government is a lucrative business, or at least it can be. You know, there's a lot of sort of very hyper-specific law that goes into that kind of topic. It can be interesting, it can be dry. And so I think, you know, one of the things you might want to do is see if he's offered before, look at what the evaluations look like.
Or see if there's a syllabus,
or see if there's a syllabus.
From the past.
It can, what's that?
What was the name of the class?
Government liability.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
873.
I mean, I know Alan.
Oh, it's the government liability and constitutional litigation. That could really be interesting.
Well, here, we might... I don't know if we share this view or not. I mean, even making it that specific, constitutional litigation could still cover a broad range of topics.
I mean, you're probably going to spend a lot of time on sovereign immunity, on official immunity, on causes of action. So there's actually a fairly heavy overlap with federal courts because both Professor Frost and I spend a lot of time on those things. But those are important topics.
I mean, what I would look for, and then this would just reflect my personal bias, if he's spending most of the class on the Federal Tort Claims Act statute, I don't think that's all that interesting. If he's spending his time on Section 1983 actions, which are civil rights actions against
state officers,
if he's spending his time on what are called Bivens actions, which would be constitutional actions against federal officers, that to me would be a lot more interesting, exciting, cutting edge. The law of those issues would be more interesting.
Even though there may actually
be more cases under the federal tort.
No, but it's about whether you're just learning doctrine created by statute or whether you're actually learning interesting sort of balancing between, you know, the need for individual liability, the need to deter misconduct, and the need to protect officers. I mean, I think that's exactly the tension.
So you might try to look and see if he's got a syllabus somewhere from the past and see what he's going to be covering.
You think it would be okay, like, go into that not having taken federal courts first?
Unless he says that federal courts is a prerequisite, I think that's a fair question to ask him. But you know, there are very few classes for which federal courts is a prerequisite. It is a new thing at WCL for so many people to take federal courts. I think most of the classes are set up on the assumption that not everyone has taken federal courts. Aaron.
Yeah, I was thinking about taking a health policy class with the healthcare bill.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one that you think particularly looks good, or maybe not a health policy class, or I don't know, just something?
I mean, there's only one that's really specifically identified as health legislative and regulatory.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, Professor Parver's class.
Professor Parver was just in the next room doing a briefing on health stuff. I don't know if she's still in there.
What I was going to say is I think without looking at the syllabi, just from their descriptions, that class looks like the one that's the most specifically about healthcare reform. The bioethics course is not going to be about healthcare reform at all. International Organizations in Health is not really going to be about that. Gender and health law and policy is not going to be about that. So, you know, if it's really about the current healthcare reform initiative, I'd focus on that course.
Which one was
that? It's 719-001, Professor Parver and Professor Hayes.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I haven't looked, but are there any courses in the AU grad schools that sort of fit in the common law, civil rights, administrative law?
I know they offer a couple of courses on main campus.
Some people in the past have taken, they do some kind of super intensive lobbying institute that sometimes people have found interesting. I think it's like a 2-week pre-start of classes thing or something. That's interesting. I mean, there's also, what's the name of the guy who's an expert on sort of presidential power, congressional power?
I know you're talking. I'm a blank slate to that.
There's a guy in the government department who's got a pretty substantial expertise on congressional power, executive branch, legislative branch relationships, and so on, who might be interesting. But
I would be a little reluctant about sort of general common law classes, just because if they're geared toward graduate students, they're going to be more heavy into policy than law. And so, you know, it might be interesting. It might not be as sort of rewarding as sort of developing your legal acumen. That's in my experience, the kinds of common law classes you see on main campus are much more into, you know, driving policy ideals versus actual substantive doctrine. But that's a limited experience, to be fair. You guys have maybe like one or two more questions? Covered everything? The whole curriculum? Yeah?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about antitrust? And like,
very little bit.
So I actually, I mean, this may come as a surprise to you guys. I actually think antitrust is one of a small number of classes that even if you have no interest in it whatsoever, it might be really fun. And the reason why I say that is because they're what we call code classes. A code class is a class about a body of law that is entirely defined by statute and by one statute in particular. And the reason why those classes can be interesting is because they are usefully discrete. Discrete, ETE, not EET. By which I mean, you know, there's really a finite body of law, and it's all about achieving certain policy ideas. Antitrust law is a fantastic example of that. The other one that I often invoke is bankruptcy, where you have a problem, and you have the government trying to sort of be the solution. And the question is, how do courts and private actors, you know, deal with this one body of law to sort of get everything to work? Antitrust is primarily about economic competition. You know, it's about like the U.S. Airways, United Airlines merger and whether that's, you know, going to be good for the economy. There's a lot of detailed statutory stuff you're going to do. You're going to spend a lot of time talking about doctrine. You know, the Supreme Court has a really important antitrust case before it this term about the National Football League. So I actually think it could be a really interesting course. You know, I don't think you should only take. I don't think you have to be an antitrust acolyte to take it. And I don't think really there are prerequisites for it. I think it's just, you know, come learn some antitrust law. Same with bankruptcy.
Like everything else, I would add two caveats. At least the last time I looked, maybe yours is more recent, didn't have who was teaching it.
What number is it?
692.
Kolaski.
Here's two things to think about. One is some people teach antitrust law with a much heavier dose of mathematics than not. Some people have less. Some people teach it all about the cases, but some people get into the underlying competition theories, which are math-driven.
Right. What should the law be versus what is the law?
So that might be a good thing or bad thing depending on your interest. So you might want to try to find out, again, depending on what you like, whether this is an adjunct, and I don't know what their approach would be. The second thing is just a practical observation, which is if you have a crystal ball about the 2012 presidential election, Democrats tend to enforce antitrust laws more actively than Republicans do. So if the Republicans win the White House in 2012, antitrust becomes a less interesting field. If the Democrats keep the White House in 2012, there are more antitrust cases out there and more antitrust work.
Here's my caveat to your caveat. Private work becomes more important if there. I mean, I think that
maybe nobody's regulating it.
But I mean, and I would say the same with bankruptcy. I mean, I think it's the exact same consideration, which is it primarily going to be taught doctrinally? Is it going to be taught through the statutes? Is it going to be taught as a theory course? You know, there are virtues and vices to each approach, but I would not count these courses out just because you don't think that in your career you want to become a bankruptcy or antitrust lawyer. There's one more class that we totally skipped over because I didn't know it was on here, but I should plug. I mentioned Professor Epperson before. She's also teaching education law. Which I guess is technically a public law class.
Unfortunately for the people that I know who would be interested in it and who are Marshall Brennan fellows, it meets at the same time as the Marshall Brennan Seminar.
Well, then don't take it.
I have been trying to change for years and haven't succeeded.
But for those of you who are not taking Marshall Brennan, education law is, in many ways, a fascinating, important, and horribly convoluted body of law that is going to be
even more horribly convoluted
going forward. So education law, you'll spend some time talking about you know, socioeconomic and racial diversity in schools. You'll spend some time talking about disabilities in schools. You'll spend some time talking about federalism and what role the federal and state governments should be playing in education. It's a whole lot of really neat and important stuff. I don't think
free speech issues, freedom of religion issues.
Yeah, I don't. My understanding, and this could be wrong, is that Professor Epperson's focus is more on the schools than on the students. By which I mean, it's less about
student
rights than it is about the law that governs public education. I don't know for a fact that that's right, but from my experience with her work, that's probably more likely. Those issues are a little more technical, but I think they're no less important. In some ways, they're actually even more structural when it comes to the future education reform and education policy. So, Jason.
What classes are both of you teaching in the spring?
That's a good question. I think I teach the Marshall Brennan seminar both semesters, so I think in the spring my other class is going to be a 1L elective version of this Supreme Court seminar that I teach.
If we ever have another faculty meeting.
But if it doesn't get approved, then maybe I'll do it in the spring as an upper level class.
That'll be approved. And I'll teach you in common law and fed courts, probably. I mean, I say probably not because I have reason to think I won't, but just because nothing's written in stone until January. What's that? No. I mean, common law and fed courts. The reason why Professor Ramil's being even remotely equivocal is just because we have to formally approve it. But that's probably a formality. Fed courts and common law are not a change in the curriculum. All right. You guys have any other questions?
Is there anything you can say about the professors teaching First Amendment and like their differences?
Well, at the moment there's only one. Dan Marcus is the only one teaching it.
Who's he doing it next year? I don't know.
I don't think Jamie's going to be able to fit it in because he's supposed to go back to teaching the evening common law section.
Right. The only other person who has been teaching the First Amendment on a regular basis lately is Professor Raskin. Professor Tsai might teach it at some point, although I don't know.
He sort of seemed to say he doesn't want to.
You'd have to ask him.
I teach it about every 3 or 4 years. If I have a hole in my my package, I'll sometimes do an evening section of First Amendment.
But my sense is that the course is often much the same, regardless of who's teaching it. That it's
the only difference is Dan Marcus is doing it as a 3-credit course. It's approved in the curriculum as up to 4 credits, and he just covers a little bit less.
And substantively, I mean, I think my sense, and you should tell me when I make this up, but my sense is that although we cover most of the First Amendment, it is heavily geared toward the free speech clause, with some time, but maybe not quite as much, on the free exercise and establishment clauses.
Yeah, I mean, he would do a few weeks of religion at the end, but it's probably 8 weeks of speech and 4 weeks of religion, or 9 weeks of speech and 3 weeks of religion, or so, you know, whatever the numbers are.
Never mind the petition clause.
To what?
Exactly.
Is the free speech, does the media fall under the free speech?
He doesn't do a lot of that. I do when I teach it. He'll cover libel in New York Times against Sullivan, but he doesn't. There's a whole body of
like reporters' privilege,
news gathering protection, and so on, access to courtrooms and information. He doesn't do most of that.
I would say, I mean, if that's a particular interest, I think we do teach a media law class.
Yeah, although that's problematic too, because Tony Verona.
That's right.
I mean, there's.
Yeah.
There's a mass media law class that Tony Verona has offered in the spring, but because he's becoming associate dean, I don't know whether he's going to teach that. I have a course that I have gotten approved and have never taught called Media and the First Amendment. It's a 2-credit course, and I'd love to teach it if I can ever figure out a time to teach it. If you see mass media law in the spring, that ought to get into some of those issues. There's a communications law course in the fall, which is more FCC regulatory stuff and not as much of that side of it. Mass media law would be a little bit more First Amendment, and then if I ever get to offer the thing got approved, it would be entirely First Amendment.
And it's probably also a very small piece of Professor Metcalf's government information law course. Although, knowing Dan, I would suspect a very small piece, since he thinks there's no press protection worth talking about.
But, I mean, there's plenty of interesting free speech stuff without, if you don't get to the media stuff. I'm not saying you shouldn't be interested in it, but
if I'm interested in kind of the media focus, then...
You may actually, I mean, another thing to think about is to pursue an independent study.
Yeah, come talk to me and then we'll figure out an independent study.
Or Lucy Dalglish. But, yeah, you first.
Well, she doesn't teach here, so she can't do it.
I was kidding. It was a funny.
What else?
Should we make this the last question?
All right.
Make it good.
That's just a really basic question.
That's fine.
When is this open for us again? I forgot.
You each have a different slot depending on your number, but Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. is the first group, I think. But you have to figure out what group you're in.
If you go to the registrar's office webpage, so if you just click from this guy onto Office of the Registrar, in the top right-hand corner there's a PDF with all the instructions that I think also specifies which digit gets which registration block.
So you might be Tuesday at noon, you might be Tuesday at 3, you might be Tuesday at 6.
That corner.
You might be Wednesday at 9 a.m., you might be last, in which case nothing we've said will matter.
That's right.
They'll all be closed.
That's right. All right, well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.